and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down that road of wrestling history, up and down the Smoky Mountains. We're going to run into Big Jim Hess today. And, of course, the man who's here to tell us the story, the greatest storyteller in wrestling today, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you?
I'm great, fine. My pleasure to be here, my man. Just enjoying life. We got a great episode today. It's a little technical, but it really sticks with the time frame we're at and putting together the television programs, leaving one station, going to another, dumping one commentator and picking up a really qualified one in his spot. And so I'm really looking forward to it and got old Lightning saddled up and I'm ready to roll when you are, my man.
Well, hold on before you get rolling there, Ron, and before Lightning tramples over everything. Just want to make sure we say here at the top of the show how thankful we are and thank all the fans for the big support for not only the latest Studcast and, of course, Studcast 100, the special 90-minute Studcast, three Welches live for the very first time, hopefully not the very last time. We'll see what we can do about doing this again because it's been so popular hearing the Tennessee Stud with Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden live on the show. And, of course, Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin has become our most popular Super Studcast to date. And we'll tell you more about both of these shows later in the show. But if you want to become a patron and hear the Super Studcast right now, you can do so. Patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. Only $2.99 gets you in the door. But Ron, today, where are we going?
Well, today, the last Studcast, I got confirmation of acceptance from WBIR television station of my program on the air, starting on Saturday, May 17th, 1975 at 2:00 in the afternoon. We're going to go and visit Big Jim's station again for the very last time. That's WTVK, the station on the mountain up there in Knoxville. And on May the 10th, that's the last program we will do out of that television station. I had a conversation with the GM and was told my show had been canceled on their station before I could tell them I was leaving for a big-time station, WBIR. And we'll begin today with the last two matches from the Knoxville card of May 9th, 1975, and the content of the TV show on May the 10th, the following day. That's going to promote May the 16th, that Friday, and the 17th, we're going to be on another television station. So we're going to talk about my conversation with wrestlers, about the station move, and the long-awaited final conversation with Big Jim Hess on that Saturday, May the 10th. We're going to also talk then about the future of Southeastern Wrestling and all that was done to make the new station's wrestling show the best studio show in the world. And that's what a lot of people said about it. And in essence, today we're saying goodbye to Jim Hess and the possible failure of Knoxville. And hello to the blast off of Southeastern Wrestling and the greatest growth era in Knoxville wrestling history because of the television station we're going to.
You said we're going to begin, Ron, with talking about the show in Knoxville. Of course, the show was Friday, May 9th, 1975. Let's talk about the last two matches on that card.
Okay. We're going to shoot this two matches in the last on the May the 9th, the last two main events. It was a double main event that night. And we're going to use that content on the Southeastern show on the old station. I'm going to call it the old station because we're leaving it the following morning. It's going to be our last program there. Ron Wright had won the Southern title match with me by virtue of his Battle Royal win on May the 2nd. And in the title match on May the 9th against me, we both end up bleeding. And after Wright hits me with the chisel early on in the match, and I was able to take it away from him, and I let him have it. So we both end up pretty bloody in that match. The referee disqualified both of us for using the foreign object. We both used the same foreign object. That's pretty unusual in the match. And then we continued to fight after the bell. And I finally got old Ron down, and I had him in pretty bad shape, and I was dealing with him pretty good. And his brother came to ringside. Started to drag him out of the ring. So I just got out of the ring, and Don's trying to get Ron over to the edge of the ring. And I sneak up behind Don. I blast him in the back. And I give him a little taste of the chisel, too. So now I got both the right boys bleeding. And about that time, the referee's trying to stop it again, and he gets knocked out. I think Ron hit him and knocked him cold. So blood was really everywhere, man. The crowd was going nuts. And then the three of us fought back to my dressing room. They fought with me back to I got to my dressing room. And then they had to part ways when we got up in that part of the building. So we had recorded the entire match and the tag match right before it, which was with the Bass Brothers, managed by Sam, against Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett. Sam Bass had to save his boys, as he was pretty good at, and he actually got a win for them. But those two matches would be returned the following Friday night on May the 16th. But we're going to take a look. Let's take a look at that entire card for May the 16th. It was a double main event, just as the week before, with the same two main events. Pretty unusual there. But I was going to have a very rare handicap match with just me against both the Wright boys. I said, what the heck? I might as well, if I'm going to end up busting them both up, might as well get them both in the ring and just see if I can beat two Wrights in one night. But my title, they wanted the title on the line, but I wouldn't put my title up for it. Obviously, if two guys beat you, you're not going to give your title up. But then the Bass Brothers in the second match on the 16th, Ron and Don were going to return to face their opponents from the week before, Jimmy Golden, Jerry Jarrett. Except this time, Les Thatcher is going to be handcuffed to Sam Bass. That's a pretty good little maneuver there. Bass has been getting involved in every match every week, saving his boys. And this time, Thatcher is going to be handcuffed to him. Also on that card is Phil Hickerson versus Steve Kovac, Jerry Bryan versus Mike Dugan, Dennis Condrey versus Tony Costello. And in the opening match on that card of May the 16th is going to be the first time ever for a young man in Southeastern who is going to become a huge star in the wrestling game. And that's Tommy Wildfire Rich. He's going to make his first Southeastern appearance, and he'll be wrestling a guy named Don Stanton on the 16th.
What were your first impressions of Tommy Rich? Because this is obviously really early in his career, and he was a kid. I mean, he was still a teenager, I think, at this point. What were your first impressions of him?
I thought he was 16 years old. I mean, I was like, wow, what is this guy, this kid doing in here? You know, he looked very, very young, obviously, but you could see it. I mean, you know, the guys that are going to be big stars usually got it from the very beginning. And Tommy had it, too. And Tommy's deal is that firing up, man. He had that tremendous comeback. He had that fire. And part of that may have come from Nick Gulas, who, you know, he worked a lot for Nick during this early time frame. And Nick was really good at taking these young kids and teaching them how to fire once they got the selling good and that comeback started, how really to get that crowd off their butt. And Tommy was great at that. And he was started out as a young guy being great at it. I watched that match that's first time he was there. And I was really impressed with just his comeback alone. He really, really got after the guy and obviously won the match. Let's take a look at how I booked the last Southeastern Wrestling TV show ever on WTVK and how I handled things with Big Jim. And that was on Saturday, May 10th, 1975. And as I said last week, after speaking with the GM of WTVK, I told no one about this being my last show on this station until the show was finished. Now, after I left that GM's office, I met with Big Jim and I passed him the format for the day's show. But as usual, he discarded it and he didn't even look to see what was on it, not even to what he was going to do that day. And he really seemed to be more interested in my state of mind. You know, I think he asked me a question about, you know, you feeling all right? You know, because that made me think that, you know, he knew what went on upstairs before I actually came downstairs. And you know, it was a real indication to me that, you know, he had a lot to do with this. And they probably had a great influence on the decision of booting me off the TV channel, which I'm glad they booted me off that station. Obviously, I didn't care because I'd be working out of a real television station the next Saturday. So I was prepared to do what I needed to do when the show finished, and I would be working with a true professional the next week sitting in Big Jim's chair. It's going to be somebody who can handle the job and do the job properly. Just because this would be the last Southeastern show on the station, I still wanted it to be a great one. I opened the show with Jerry Jarrett. He was making a very rare appearance live on Knoxville TV because he ran the Memphis TV on the Memphis side of the state. And obviously being in Knoxville, I don't know who ran it for him that day, but I got him, talked him into staying there. I wanted him to have a tag match with his new partner, Jimmy Golden. And Jimmy's really over at this point. So I sent them at the first segment of this show on May the 10th, the last one on WTVK. I sent both those two guys to the desk after they had a big win in the ring. And I showed them show the match where Sam Bass had interfered the match and helped his boys to win. Well, both Jarrett and Golden did a great job, obviously, talking over the match and emphasizing the fact that they had the Bass boys beaten and would have been champions that morning if not for Sam Bass. They then invited out their ace in the hole for the next Friday night. That was Les Thatcher. He would be handcuffed to Sam Bass. Thatcher got the studio crowd really pumped up by saying he was going to have them not to handcuff them with their hands together, but with their ankles together so that he could beat the hell out of Sam Bass even with handcuffs. So, and I thought that was a great part of the interview. Crowd really liked that. Golden and Jarrett finished the interview by assuring that they're going to end up being Tennessee tag champions by the next Saturday. So led in great to that event that was coming up the following Friday. The second segment had a young guy, first time on Southeastern, Tommy Rich, fire up, as he says, for a big win over Dennis Condrey right there on TV. The third segment was the All Basses, as Ron and Don sported their Tennessee tag belts and got another win on TV. Then they went to the desk with their manager, Sam, and bitched about having to defend their titles when their manager was going to be handcuffed to Les Thatcher. The Bass boys painted a picture of poor old Les being hauled off to the hospital at the end of all this after they finished whipping their tag opponents, because all three of them are going to get on Thatcher and he's going to be handcuffed, so they'll all be able to beat him to pieces. And so, you know, that led up to a good presentation for the next week as well. The last segment in that show was all the Wright brothers. They wrestled in the tag. I put them in a tag match on TV. They won their tag match. And then they went to the desk and joined old Big Jim to brag about how easily they just beat two men. And imagine what they were going to do next Friday against just me alone. The studio crowd obviously loved it. Big Jim introduced the film of the match the night before. That's where I hit him, hit both those guys with the chisel. And they emphasized the fact, you know, Ron wanted to talk about the fact, you know, the bell had rung and they had stopped the match. And Don came down there just to try to drag me out of the ring. And he sneaks around. Look how he's sneaking around behind him. And then he turns him around and hits him with the chisel. And then they explain the reason for the handicap match, saying if I wanted to bust them both open, then why not have a match against both of them at the same time? So that seemed like a pretty good way to put it in a way. So Big Jim obviously loved the entire segment. And he made it pretty obvious that he did. You know, oh boy, he had his right boys there. It was just a WTVK big holiday for him. So I go on at the end of the show, and I close the show screaming about who at Southeastern Wrestling. Yeah, I always spent a lot of time. I didn't want them to know I owned it. I always knocked Southeastern Wrestling and the people that ran it. And I screamed about who at Southeastern Wrestling felt like I should wrestle both the Wright brothers by myself. I said, how does anybody believe I can do that and win? Well, the fans and Big Jim were loving it and really into it. But after I screamed a little bit, I kind of changed my tone. I quit screaming and I calmly reached into my pocket and I pulled out the chisel. I said, did all you hillbillies forget who left the ring with the only weapon your Wright brothers really have? And I didn't put that chisel on my hand. And I said to the cameraman, get in here a real close up of this bloody tool that these Wright boys have designed and built so that they could win matches. And because this right here, what's on my hand, is going to be the equalizer next Friday night, I guarantee that both those Wright boys are going to leave the ring in worse shape than they were today with their little taped heads from last night. So I finished with the idiots at Southeastern Wrestling need to have an ambulance there next Friday night for this match, because I'm going to open up both their heads with this chisel. And then all that's left is Mama Wright crying when she gets a look at her precious boys next week. So I had myself some fun too at the same time.
So this is your last show at WTVK. Not your favorite place, but were you happy with this as your last show?
Yeah, I really was. I was happy with the content of the show. I was happy with the crowd's reaction. Obviously, I was not happy with Big Jim. Never was happy with him. But and I went back to the dressing room when the program was over, and I gathered all the boys up because I had just been received the notice before the show started from upstairs that we weren't coming back there. And Big Jim wanted to step in and hear what I had to say to the boys. And I told him, no, Jim, you got to wait outside. And I said, I'll be out there and I'll pay you in a minute. And I closed the door in his face. I think he really wanted to hear what I had to say to my guys, you know, but I didn't want him there. So I closed the door right in his face. And I probably spent about 10 minutes talking to everyone in the dressing room at once. That was probably my first speech like that I had done since I bought the company. And it was just a few things that I spoke about. I started with a brief discussion, I think, about what I had thought was possible when I bought Knoxville. I told all the guys in there that it was my opinion shortly after I arrived that I felt like this particular station, and I'm talking about WTVK, we're sitting in there and having this conversation where we presently are, and our commentators here would never be able to get us where we needed to be, and certainly not where I wanted to be. I told him how I viewed Knoxville as a potential territory, not just a city to wrestle in. I said this station's signal was not strong enough, nor their production crew nearly sharp enough to get us there. I told them about my visit to WBIR Channel 10, first time I had spoken to anybody other than Les Thatcher about it. And I told them that this TV channel station has the strongest signal of any television station in the state of Tennessee. And that's where we're going to be doing our show from next Saturday, and hopefully forever from this point on. I said we had all been working hard since I took over. But starting next Saturday, another 250,000 viewers in 5 states are going to have an opportunity to see us every Saturday from then on. That's a lot of viewership. You add 250,000 people to your viewing audience, potentially. That's really a big number. So hopefully, I continued with it, hopefully in less than a year, Knoxville will be not just a city to visit on Friday and work in, but a place to find a home and stay like any other territory you work in. I told them that I thought that there would be a day come when that we can make that Coliseum that we worked in a couple of weeks earlier our permanent home. and that I could see a day coming when guys would make $1,000 a week here and be home every night by midnight or before midnight. I thanked them for the TV that they had just finished, and I told them to expect to see the best studio wrestling show next week that they had ever seen. I left the dressing room that was buzzing about what was to come and went outside to find old Big Jim.
After you kicked him out of the room, he just stood outside the door?
Yeah. I mean, when I opened the door, I almost banged the door into him. I think he's listening through the door. He's trying to hear what I had to say, because he knew what was going on, So when I opened the door to leave, there he was. He's not far away, and I figured he'd heard every word I said, and I didn't care, So I handed him his pay in cash, as I'd done every Saturday since my arrival in Knoxville. And as best I can remember, this was kind of what I said. Jim had nothing. He had no part in this conversation. I kind of just told him everything I wanted to tell him. I said something like, Jim, I know we've not had the best relationship. I know you don't like what I have tried to do with this TV show here. I know you're a big part of this station and have a great deal of influence here. I got the feeling this morning, I told him, that you were aware of what was going to happen here today concerning my show on this station. And I said, in fact, Jim, I'm pretty sure you had a hand in it. I went right on and laid it out there. Whether or not you actually did, I'll probably never know, I told him. I do know I tried to make a better commentator out of you, but you had your own ideas about how wrestling shows should be done. You're probably aware your GM gave me a notice this morning when I arrived that this was my last show here. Now, I'm going to tell you what I didn't tell him, and you can take this message to him today, I told him, before you leave. I will not be off of television in Knoxville for a single week. In fact, I will be on a much larger and better station than this one come next Saturday. And if you guys here want to see and tell your GM that if you guys and he would like to see a quality TV wrestling show next week, they can tune in to WBIR at 2:00 on Saturday afternoon, and they will see the best and the way it should be done. And then I continued on. What happened to me this morning upstairs could have been the end of my dream to own not just a town, but a territory. I saw it coming, Jim. And I beat you guys to the punch. I know you're not going to like this statement, but in a way, Jim, you are responsible for my success rather than my failure. Your constant pain in my ass attitude each Saturday and horrible job done every time you opened your mouth forced me to find another station. You and all the management here know that WBIR is capable of and is going to do for Southeastern Wrestling now. Since the GM here blamed my cancellation on the rating books, you can tell him to pay particular attention to the wrestling numbers in this market at 2 p.m. on Saturdays from here on out. You are, as a salesman here, Jim, can forget trying to sell spots that compete with us at that 2 p.m. time slot. Your station will have no chance to make money at 2:00 to 3:00 anymore. I told him at the very end, I know you would love to be a part of the great wrestling show that will come out of WBIR and the huge audience we're going to produce at Channel 10. But sorry, Jim, it's not going to happen. And then I think I said at the end, I'm about to say the most pleasing thing that I've ever said to you, Jim. You're fired. And at that point, he began to speak, but I never stopped. I turned around to walk away. I never stopped. I never looked back. There was nothing he could say that could change anything or would change anything. And that was the very last time I ever saw Big Jim Hess in person.
Did anyone speak up on his behalf? I mean, we've always heard that Ron Wright and him had a good relationship. Did Ron Wright say, hey, Ron, you're making a mistake. You got to bring Big Jim with us. No. Did anyone do that?
No, never. And, I don't think he had many fans other than probably Ron. And I don't think Ron was really a fan. I think Ron Wright realized that Jim was not good for business and that he was limiting the audience that could be built for a wrestling show. But he liked the banter back and forth. It made Ron Wright a star on that program. But to me, I don't need a commentator that's a star because he's not booked on any of those cards. He's not going to draw me any money. The commentator's job is to get everybody else over. And if you're just trying to get one guy over, when you have a territory and you've got 16, 18 really great workers there, and you've got a commentator that wants to focus on one guy and get him really hot, well, that's not doing what you need to do for your territory. And I wanted no part of it. I wanted to let Jim know exactly how I felt about it at the very end. And I didn't think he deserved the opportunity to try to, I don't know, anything he could have said to change my opinion at that point. My mind was made up. Not only was my mind made up, the deal was done. We were moving. We were going. And that was the end for Big Jim.
The newspaper ads would soon read, at the bottom under the card, "Watch the new wrestling program, WBIR Channel 10, Saturdays 2 p.m., or see it live at the studio, Saturday 11:30 a.m., free." And we will be right back with more of the Studcast after this, a word about Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin.
Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin is the all-time biggest Super Studcast so far. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. This one covers everything accomplished by the former NWA World Champion with his win over Ric Flair in part one and deals in part two with the really tough issues of the destructive 1979 Knoxville Wrestling War. No subject is avoided in this one, not even the shocking Plan B video made by the Knoxville Five and hidden for 40 years. This Super Studcast is a perfect example of the depth and detail that the Stud is willing to go to for his fans and a testament to the heart of these two ring warriors to discuss such a difficult subject and come out friends again. Only $2.99 for three fantastic hours of pure wrestling history at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast.
Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin, our most popular Super Studcast to date. Check it out today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. For only $2.99, you get in the door and you get to hear all of the Super Studcast, all of the rest of the stories. And this one is an amazing Super Studcast. And of course, the rest of the story deals with the Knoxville Wrestling War. For the first time ever, Ron gets to speak one-on-one on the air with a member of the Knoxville Five. You have to hear this today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But by the time we got to 1979, Knoxville was considered to be maybe the best studio wrestling show in the country, certainly one of the most revolutionary wrestling television shows of all time, and maybe the most revolutionary wrestling show of its era. Ron, how was that show created? How was it designed? How did you build that kind of show with that kind of reputation on WBIR in Knoxville?
Well, let's just start out with a little list of what Les and I did. We only had 2 weeks. Bear in mind, we only had 2 weeks to accomplish this, too, because they didn't give us a long time frame. Once I made that presentation to us 3 days later, toward the end of that week, I did it on a Monday. By Friday, they call me. They say within 2 weeks on a Saturday, we want to start you. Didn't give us much time, but there was so much to do because we're not putting together a regular wrestling program. We're going to put together something that's never been seen before. So here's kind of some of the things that we had to do in 2 weeks' time. We had to find a ring announcer for the show that could also join Les at the desk when necessary and do great audio cuts to be added to the show. We're going to have a custom-made logo designed for Southeastern Wrestling that's totally different than anybody else's logo. We're going to create a unique opening for the TV show that actually put that new logo into motion. That's a feat in itself. Took a lot of work to get that done. We're going to design a beautiful set for the show. We're going to utilize a Greek statue that I owned of two wrestlers on the show. We're going to create bumpers using that same statue to open and close all the segments of the show and present a seamless transition from one part of the show to the next. We're going to create the use of Vitifont that no one had been doing anywhere in the country that would not only show people the card, but allow them to read it on the screen at the same time as it was being announced. We're going to figure out how to produce instant replays on all finishes of every match. And finally, we're going to create a split screen. We're going to create something never been done before, the use of split screen. It's a special effect by using two camera angles on the same screen at the same time that will show two sides of the ring in one shot. Never been done. We're going to utilize it a lot during the course of Southeastern's first days there and all the time that we are there with Southeastern. These things all had to be done in what was called pre-production or prior to any show being done. This had to be all done before that Saturday that we're doing that first show. Everything had to be put together. So that's only about 9 things so far that were done in that period of time. And every single one of those things had never been done on a television wrestling show anywhere in the world before this day. And I want to explain each of them and how they were done and why they were important to a TV wrestling show.
Hey, Ron, if I could ask you real quick, before we get to all this, in terms of this period of time, early 1975, and even if we look at, let's say, for the last year before this, I know you can't speak for Les, and if you do know anything about Les's viewing habits, please speak up. But for you, how much time did you get to spend watching any national sports, watching any national broadcasts of basketball or football, or I don't know if you ever watch any baseball, we've never talked baseball, but at least football or basketball. How much time did you get to see what was happening in terms of production in national sports?
I was a big sports fan. I love football. I love basketball, obviously, played it in college. I like baseball. I really love all different types of sports. And I paid particular attention to these nationally produced shows because they have the ability and the equipment and the skills and the knowledge of how to do all of this stuff. But no one was doing it on the level that I was, and no one was doing it out of these local television stations and trying to do what they were doing on a national level. And that's basically what I designed this to compete with a show on a national level. This show was so far ahead of its time. It was really amazing. And when I used to go to the NWA meetings every year, they would put me up in front of everybody every year and say, "Ron, what are you doing now?" They really loved it. I mean, I would talk to the guys and the promoters from all around the world, just like our conversation now, and say, "You can do this and you can do that. And here's what you do and here's how you do it." And they loved it. The guys were learning stuff. You know, I was like, "Wow, this kid's way ahead of us." So, it was a big thing for me. But yeah, I watched those national sports programs because they were so good. Their production was so good.
Were you into boxing? Were you watching the big fights?
I watched some boxing too. Yes, I sure did whenever I had the chance. It's such a phenomenal difference between the local productions of any product on television during those days and what's happening on the national level. And for me to be wanting to try to get to a national level type production with a local station in 1975 was unheard of. No one did it. Wrestling promoters didn't think your television show was that important. They just thought what you did out there on it was important. And I think they missed the boat, a lot of them, because it's a two-way street. Obviously, the matches and what happens in the storyline is all tremendously important. But when you can add all these technical, beautiful technical additions to it, you got a heck of a product. And that's what we were lucky enough to be able to do in 1975.
So when did you get to go back to WBIR after all this and meet with the staff there to get everything arranged?
I think on Monday, May 5th, I got the call on May the 2nd, on Friday, May 2nd, and the GM welcomed me, said, "We want your program." And I said, "I would like to come in on Monday. I want to get started. There's a lot of things I want to do that's never been done on television wrestling program before." And so he brought me in. So 3 days after his telling me that I was going to be on the station, I'm sitting there in his office. I wanted to meet the director. I wanted to meet the production manager. I wanted to meet the cameraman that was going to be responsible for the new show. And I'd done the same thing at the old station at TVK where Big Jim was. But I knew instantly when I met those people and I talked to them for a few minutes that they were not interested in me or any of the thoughts that I might have about improving the wrestling show. They didn't care. And this meeting that I'm about to have at WBIR, this first one, is going to be completely different from the one I had at Big Jim Station. The GM introduced me to both the director and the production manager and allowed me time to spend with both of them, quite a bit of time by myself with them. The production manager was in his 40s, and he had an air about him of knowledge and competence. I mean, this guy, you could just tell he knew what he was doing. He showed me the studios in the building, two small studios separated from the other two larger ones. The biggest studio was half again larger than the Big Jim Hess studio at WDVK. It would hold at least twice as many fans as the old studio, and it had a great background wall that allowed me the opportunity to show logos on it, to put special lighting effects on it. Rather than just having a blank wall back there, it gave me opportunity to do more things. Even beyond these nine that I've laid out, there's a lot more things that we did in this show. And that's one of them is utilize that big studio and that big back wall behind the ring. The production manager introduced me to the three cameramen that's going to be part of the crew working every Saturday for the show. And all of them were young, and I was really soon to find out, but they were extremely proficient at their job. Gosh, these young cameramen were just absolutely unreal. The thing that really jumped out to me, though, was the fact that we're not going to have two cameras like we did at TVK. They're going to give us three cameras. And there's no way you can compare two cameras to three cameras. It's just hard to explain how much difference there is between that third shot and just that normal two that you always get. So I could just tell, my excitement level just jumped out the roof when he said three cameras. You know, I was like, whoa, man, it just said to me, they're committed. These guys are committed to doing something unbelievable here. And, that's what Les and I wanted. We wanted to do something unbelievable. So the second studio he showed me was just perfect for the personality profile segment that's going to be in the middle of every show. So I couldn't have been more pleased with that studio tour. It just rocked my world, man. I was like on cloud nine. So next was my introduction to the new director. And, this one, it really is something for me. I enjoyed just talking about it. I was first struck by this young director's age when I was introduced to him. He was a young boy. I couldn't believe he was 20 years old. I thought, this kid can't be 20 years old. How is he a director on a television station like that? He was a black kid, and there wasn't a big black population in Knoxville. But his race was no concern to me. I didn't care about that at all. I wondered if he was a wrestling fan or had he watched many wrestling shows. I sat down and I spent probably 30 minutes with him, and I did my best to describe what I wanted the show to look like and what I wanted to accomplish each week and how I wanted the fans to can't wait to the next Saturday to see the next one. We talked about his experience in the business, and it didn't take long for me to figure out that this young man was a director because he had earned that position. He darn sure knew his stuff. The guy's name was Bill Kincaid, becomes a personal friend of mine, a great guy, and he's going to make Southeastern Wrestling a famous program in that market. And I say he because he does so much to get it done himself. I told him about wanted to do instant replay and split screen, and he never batted an eye. It was like, whoa, you know, no big deal. You know, and then, in fact, by the end of conversation, I asked him if he thought he could do all the things that would be involved in this show, and I will never forget his response to that question. You know, I'd run so many things by him. I said, "Do you think you can do all of this?" And he said to me, I'll never forget it. He said, "Ron, I can walk on water." And I got to admit, over the next 4 years, I saw him walk on water many, many times. He was unbelievable. Couldn't have had a better director for that program.
Ron, let's get back to that list you said you had of nine things that had to be ready before your first WBIR television show, which was coming up just this weekend on Saturday.
Okay, well, let's start at the top of it. Let's start with hiring a television ring announcer, an audio man. This one was so difficult because Les and I knew we wanted one of the new station's employees to fill that position. They let us interview about eight different people they thought would be right, and we selected the sixth candidate as soon as he interviewed. We didn't get to the eighth. He was perfect, and his name was Phil Rainey. He was a short guy and not too big in size. And that was great because he, as being a ring announcer, he's going to be standing near these big, huge wrestlers in the ring and introducing them. And his size is going to make them look even bigger. And I love that. You know, this guy's going to make our boys look like monsters in there just being introduced. He had this tremendous announcer's voice that made him sound much larger than his stature was. And he was a diehard wrestling fan. And so much so that my first question during the interview for him was, what did he think of Big Jim Hess? and he got the job when he answered it. And I remember his answer. He said, "I think he wants to be a wrestler rather than an announcer or a commentator." He nailed it right on the head. So Phil Rainey and Les Thatcher are going to work for Southeastern Wrestling until I leave after the Wrestling War of 1979. And both of those guys are going to be hired by the new owner that buys me out, Jim Barnett. So that says a lot. Barnett's been around the world. He knows wrestling. And he took both those guys. He did not change a single thing about that program. And he was smart not to get into that part of it.
How beneficial is it to one of the territories if one of the guys on your broadcast, if not both of the guys on your broadcast, is someone who doesn't just do wrestling, but someone involved with the local news or someone involved with the local station so that they're an on-air personality? How big of a help is that to establishing the wrestling show?
It's big. It's very, very big. That's why I told when we started to talk about hiring the guy, I said, we want to go to BIR. We want to hire directly out of their staff because I wanted that. It's your television wrestling program becomes your station. It's a partnership. It's not just a television program that they just lack lusterly, don't care. We're going to go in there and we'll get this done and we'll get out of there. These guys are committed to it. And as things go on here, I'm just more and more impressed with how committed they are to taking this wrestling show and not just doing it like it was done at TVK, to take it and just make it such a monumental, wonderful product. It was just great to be involved with people that wanted it rather than a guy like Big Jim who wanted to do his own thing and didn't care whether your audience grew or not. So let's tackle the development of the logo. You know, and there's a lot of work in that. Les and I had been talking about creating a logo for the company that was different than anyone else's logo in the wrestling business. This was one of the two things that took a little longer to get done properly than the other things on this list of nine things. We started working on this 2 months before the meeting with the new television station. I wanted the logo, but I was not going to expose something that I didn't think was right. So Les had a relationship in Charlotte, North Carolina, where he lived at that point, with a company that designed logos. they produced many prototypes for us, and we selected the one that became the Southeastern Wrestling logo. And then we decided to take that logo a step further and put it to take that logo and put it into action. The logo is of two wrestlers locked up together, and there's a circle around it with the name Southeastern Championship Wrestling. And we wanted to take, for the opening of the show, that logo and have those wrestlers part, separate, walk around like wrestlers do. One of them flying mares, another one over his shoulder, and then they lock back up again. So that's a lot of work when you start doing that type of stuff, because they've got to paint all these or color and put together all these different images and then make this happen. So it took about 6 weeks of artwork to get the two wrestlers that were locked up in the logo to be able to move and put wrestling holds on each other and then return to the locked up position. We finally got the entire maneuver down to about 30 seconds, and then we added the perfect Phil Rainey audio behind it, our new guy, beautiful job, to describe what the fans were about to encounter in the next hour that made our show totally different than any other wrestling TV show in the world. The next piece was to design a beautiful and different set, the likes of which had never been seen on any wrestling show ever. Again, the news station was able to help us with this one. They had retired a three-sided set that had been used for weather forecasts. They offered it to us and agreed to have someone at the station do the actual work we wanted and needed to make the set work for us. It was big. It was about 10 feet high and 12 feet wide. It had 6 2-foot-wide sections side by side that created that 12-foot distance. And bear in mind that this set had three distinct sides, and each side rotated together from one background to another. And all Les had to do was step on a button on the floor at his feet under the desk, and instantly the background behind him would mysteriously change entirely. So in essence, this monstrosity, this awesome monstrosity of a set was absolutely unbelievable. Fans would go nuts just changing the background, and could never figure out how and why. How did that work? You know, never saw the button. Nobody even knew there was a button there. One side of the set was orange, and it had white letters all the way across spelling out from top to bottom Southeastern Championship Wrestling in three rows. The second side displayed 6 photos, 2 feet high by 2 feet wide, of current stars staggered across all 6 sections. The posed and sometimes action shots, we used pose shots a lot, but sometimes we took action shots. And since Ronnie Garvin's in this last Super Studcast, he had an action shot jumping off the top rope in the throat of the Andre the Giant. I mean, you know, we had some tremendous, really great action shots too. These action shots and pose shots are bordered in white frames, and it created an awesome effect when Les would rotate that set from the southeastern side to the photo side, and the camera would be on him. So without anyone watching out there really realizing how it was happened, they would watch those frames turn, and all of a sudden you've got a totally new set back there. The third side of the set was a chroma key blue, without a photo of some kind projected on it. It was just a plain blue background. But when used properly, it was fantastic. The chroma key third side enabled it to instantly display any photo you wanted to project on top of that chroma key. So to fans, when this side turned into view, you could have a photo on the inside of the Coliseum with a sold-out crowd or any picture you wanted to use. So this set went far beyond anything we could have produced ourselves or even envisioned. It weighed more than 1,000 pounds. And when I left Knoxville in 1979, I had it shipped to the television station in Southeastern Southern Division where our show down there was going to be done. We used that set until 1985 when Continental Wrestling was born.
What'd you do then? What'd you do with it once
I think we finally trashed it at that point, you know, because Continental was done in a building. It was a different type of production, 6-camera production rather than a 3-camera production. It was Southeastern was done because we wanted to compete with Vince, and we had to have a different set because it was on a grand stage. It was just a totally different production than a studio production. We went into the arena that held 7,000-8,000 Boutwell Auditorium in Birmingham, and we shot television programs a lot of nights with 8,000 people in there instead of 200 like in a studio. Well, you can imagine it just makes for a better. It's just no comparison.
So everything you just talked about, everything you talked about with the background, forget about the logo because you said that was already being worked on for a while. How long did it take? I mean, did you set up this whole background in just the 1 week that you had to get everything set up for the show?
Yes. Yes. I mean, Les came to Knoxville. We did not work. We did not go anywhere but to television station every day. We worked on every bit of this every day. And like I said, the TV station was cooperating with us. They gave us employees. They said, you want that painted? Yes, paint that orange. You want this white? Paint that white. You want this guy to do this? Do that? I mean, they were just unbelievable in trying to help us get this ready because they realized what we're doing is going to make this show unbelievable. It will be like no other wrestling show that's ever been done. And I had this Greek statue that I talked about earlier that it had two pictures. It had two Greek wrestlers wrestling each other, and they're locked up in a down position. And one of those wrestlers is shooting to try to get a grapevine on the other figure. Now, that move was the most important part of my father's famous Fuller leg lock. And that's why I bought that statue, is because you could see him going into that grapevine. And, so I bought this statue many years earlier before I came to Knoxville. And the statue is about 12 inches tall, maybe 18 inches wide. And it's set on top of a wooden plaque. It was made of a dark stone and it was very heavy. And we placed it in the middle of the desk for every show, and it became synonymous over the years with Southeastern Wrestling. Only months after it being viewed each week on the new show, I found several shops where these statues were for sale. They had become so popular that people were buying them in the Knoxville area. And other territories would use the same statue as time went by. Memphis Wrestling Program, you'll see it on their desk. They didn't do it before we did. They saw it and copied it from us. So we started that out. And Les and I spent many days with the production crew of the new station doing pre-production work, you know, like we've already just talked about. I mean, we were there constantly. And we were not through with the statue. Les and I wanted to create what we call bumpers. And this was just another idea that no one in the sport had ever done before. They were like small 10 to 15 second close-up shots of the statue shown at the end of every segment of our show. They ran right before the television station's 8 minutes of commercial time at each commercial break in the show. And it provided a smooth transition from the end of a match on a live show to either a television station's commercial or an interview that we had coming up promoting the next event. The new TV station wanted everything we thought of to be perfect, the opposite of what Big Jim Hess and WTVK had done. The old station fought against any changes I suggested for the show, and it was probably because of Big Jim. He didn't like me. So Channel 10 not only loved the bumper idea, they helped make us much, much better than we had ever imagined it would be. We wanted just a still shot of the statue only for the bumper. Their production crew came up with something totally different. They placed a statue on a record play and turntable, and they put it in a dark place with a small spotlight pointing straight down upon it as it slowly turned on a turntable. This allowed the audience to see a spotlighted 360-degree shot of the statue. You didn't just see the back of it or the other side of it. You saw the entire thing as it rotated around. The impact was greatly enhanced, and it was another small detail that added to making Southeastern Wrestling's television show the best studio wrestling show in the world.
Did you already have the animated open ready by the time you launched episode one?
Oh, yes.
Where'd you guys get the idea for that?
We first started working on trying to design the logo. And once we got the logo designed, then it was just a natural thing. I said, man, why don't we take this logo and let's go back to the people that designed the logo and let them make us an opening, a 30-second opening in which these wrestlers that are locked up become live. They start moving around. And we can do a flying mare. We had them do a couple of different wrestling moves in that 30-second period of time. And then they locked back up in the exact position in which the logo started out. Made for a great introduction. It made for a super opening for the show. By the time you put the music behind it and you put that that Phil Rainey voice back there, it was really, really a killer opening. I was extremely happy with it. The next thing we were tackling was the use of Vitaphone. And I'd always wondered why every wrestling show I'd ever been on had a commentator read the card to the fans as the camera remained on him. I felt like fans would relate and remember a total card better if they had the opportunity to read it on the screen and hear it from the commentator at the same time. It would have double the impact, and it did. It did exactly what I thought it would. Fans really loved the fact that they could see the names come up and hear Les talk about it at the same time. They get it. It sticks in their head. Most stations at that time had the ability to do it. They all had Vitaphone, but I guess no one had thought about it. No one had ever thought of doing it that way and announcing your cards that way. My new director of the show, Bill Kincaid, loved the idea. And as everything else with the station, he took that idea to another level. He did the first few shows with just a standard color in the background with the wrestlers' names over it. Les would read the names as they appeared on the screen. Then one day I came in the director's booth and he had mixed a background of infinite colors that were moving around in the background, mixing themselves as the card was rolling over top of it. It's just another thing that drew your eyes to the screen. Now you got three reasons to look and three reasons to listen to it. There's another small detail that had a profound effect on the product that we were doing. These Vitaphone cards and backgrounds were done for every market as we expanded to other stations across the Southeast. By 1976, all the wrestlers that worked in the territory would arrive at the studio each Saturday, 90 minutes prior to the start of the television show, to do interviews for TV stations in Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia. We were branching out and going other places, and this show was kicking butt wherever we took it. Now, we've discussed some new things are being done on this new show, but maybe the biggest new thing was the instant replay. Instant replay was already being used on national productions for many different types of sports. Many local stations across the country had the technology, but not the need for instant replay. They weren't producing wrestling shows. They weren't producing sports programming, but they had the technology there. So I wanted this instant replay. And when I mentioned it to the GM of WBIR, he said, I want it too. And so they wanted to produce the best wrestling show in the world just as much as I did. I remember the GM going down to the production department of the station with me to talk about whether we could do instant replays or not with their production manager. That guy was as interested in the idea as we were. The production manager took us over to two new side-by-side giant 2-inch tape machines that would be recording the show. He sent the director into the control room, and within 15 minutes, they had figured out how to do instant replay. I was amazed at the ability of this group of guys that was going to be working with me for the next 4 years doing television every day. While we were there, instant replay was solved, I brought up the split screen idea. The production manager, the director, three cameramen went to work right then, when within 15 minutes recorded the first split screen shot ever done at that station and probably any other local station in the world. And my excitement level was off the chart at that point. It appeared to me that not only could the director really walk on water, but so could everybody else there. They could all walk on water. They were doing things for us that we had never even thought of. So I couldn't wait till Saturday, May 17th, 1975, when Southeastern and WBIR are going to combine their talents to show the first Southeastern wrestling show ever and the best wrestling show that had ever been made. And we're going to finish today's birth of Southeastern Wrestling on WBIR on May 17th. I was already astounded by the commitment of the station, obviously, to make my show a success, but blown away when the GM told me about their plans to promote the show. Now, on that first Monday that I went in and sat down and talked to the people, on that same day, he spent time with me and him in his office, and he wanted to explain to me their promotion idea for Southeastern Wrestling. I wanted to promote and present wrestling. He wanted to promote, present wrestling on his station as it had never been done before. He wanted to use me as a spokesman for the spot and the show, dressed in a suit instead of the traditional wrestling attire. I was already intrigued when he said that. You know, I thought, you know, well, wrestling, but then he said, no, let me tell you what my idea is. He wanted to begin the promotion on the same Saturday as the last show of the other station on WTVK. He then said the spot would run on every unsold opening available on the station for a whole month. He was going to give me literally hundreds of spots advertising Southeastern Wrestling. Unheard of. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So I said, what is the spot going to look like? And he says, Ron, the spot's going to open with photos of carvings of wrestlers on the walls of Egyptian pyramids. Then we're going to fade into the bumper statue revolving on the turntable, and then to you dressed in a suit with the Southern belt over your shoulder. The script went something like this, and I was totally responsible to sell it, obviously. Here was basically the script as I remember it. On the walls of Egyptian pyramids are drawings of wrestlings more than 4,000 years ago. The Greeks refined and loved wrestling. It is the oldest sport known to man. Now WBIR proudly welcomes the wrestlers of today and the stars of tomorrow every Saturday at 2 p.m. for the greatest wrestling program on earth, Southeastern Championship Wrestling. And he laid that out for me. You know, I was like, at that point, I could not have felt any better about my chances of success for Southeastern Wrestling. So I left the station that day on fire. I went straight to Lamar Outdoor Billboard Company, my first buy ever with a billboard company, and gave them the artwork, put a wrestling shot in the background, displayed the television station's call letters and the time of the show each Saturday. And I'd already done that to the newspaper ads, as you read earlier. I felt for the first time since buying Knoxville that I was not just in this alone now, but I had a real TV partner in it with me as well. I felt really like I had a real bright future ahead of me in Knoxville.
Well, Ron, as we wrap things up, we want to remind the listeners that they can become friends with you on Facebook. Your Facebook page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Stud on Twitter and Instagram at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast for classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor. The 605 Super Podcast. We want to remind everyone that the Studcast is now also available on YouTube. You can go and listen to the show on YouTube and check out the amazing and exclusive Travis Heckel artwork. You got to see it to believe it. It's something that every fan of the Studcast should check out. And I know we have a lot of new listeners because of the YouTube version of the show. We want to say hello to everyone. But once again, you could check out the show now on YouTube on the Arcadian Vanguard video channel. Go there right now. Just search for Ron Fuller or Studcast, and it'll take you right there. And on the topic of Studcast, let's talk about Super Studcast number 18 with Ronnie Garvin, part 1 and 2. It is absolutely another record breaker. Most popular Super Studcast to date, and this one has everything from a lengthy discussion between Ron and Ronnie about Ronnie Garvin's long career. Think about it. He starts in Montreal, goes to Boston, ends up all over the South, ends up as the NWA champion one day, and then, of course, part two, where we dive into the Knoxville Wrestling War for the first time ever. Ron gets to talk with a member of the Knoxville Five on the air live. You have to check this out. He gets a lot of questions he's had for many years finally answered. You can hear this right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 gets you in the door. And we want to say thank you to all the new patrons, as well as all of our existing patrons. But welcome to all the new patrons. We appreciate you checking out the Super Studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to put this fantastic new wrestling show on the air for the very first time. And Southeastern is going to present for the first time ever a 7-match card at Chilhowee Park. I'm going to be shocked when Southeastern Wrestling gets delivered a lawsuit from that old Danny Hodge and Dale Lewis disaster with the $1,000 challenger injury. That's going to finally come back to bite me in the butt. And I'm going to start seriously reloading talent to prepare for the summer of 1975. We got a lot going on, Brian, that's for sure.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.